gusting to 26 miles per hour, 32 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are shifting around our morning schedule just a little bit, playing today the interview originally scheduled for tomorrow. And we hope that by tomorrow we're going to be able to offer up a preview of the next theatrical production at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, a really intriguing sounding play called Hand to God. But in the meantime, here we go with today's morning show. Please enjoy. Well, I have a feeling I don't need to tell any of you listening to this interview that we recently experienced a dramatic presidential election here in the United States. And of course, in the wake of that election, some were elated and relieved, some were devastated and deeply disappointed. And of course, all kinds of people on both sides of the aisle are looking at why that election turned out the way it did. And it speaks to the way in which elections occur in the 21st century, the factors that are so important in terms of who votes and for whom they vote and what drives voters to make the decisions that they do, and how should campaigns be waged in the 21st century. My guest, Robert Creamer, is very experienced in this arena. He has been a political strategist and organizer for five decades, a founding partner of Democracy Partners, creator of the largest public interest coalition in the state of Illinois, someone who has worked tirelessly on a number of different concerns and issues, including advocating very strongly for passage of the Affordable Care Act under the Obama administration. He has worked on the progressive side of the political sphere, and he also happens to be the husband of a longtime congresswoman from Illinois, Jan Schakowsky. His new book is called Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success, in which he examines a number of key ingredients in successful political campaigns and touches on a number of important matters that a lot of the rest of us sort of on the sidelines tend to not perhaps pay much attention to or have maybe even any significant awareness of. I learned a lot from this book, which is published by Strong Arm Press, and I'm excited to be able to speak with its author. Again, the book is Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success. And Robert Creamer, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's great to be with you.
Ahead of us, talking specifically about your book and this recently completed election, I wonder if we could maybe just get a sketch of what sorts of things drew you into the political arena in the first place. I mean, and clearly, this is something that has been a part of your life for a very, very long time. How did it begin?
Well, it has. I was involved. I grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana, and was involved in the civil rights movement as a young man. And when I went to Duke University in 1968, Martin Luther King was killed, and a lot of us gathered up to go have a protest at the president of the university's house. He was a pretty progressive guy, but we had demands for him. We wanted him to recognize the non-academic employees union, predominantly black, and raise their salaries from piddly amounts of money, and resigned from the All White Country Club. And we told him, we're not leaving the house until you do it. He was a pretty good guy, and we didn't get arrested or anything for a couple of days. And then the head of student activities comes in and says, well, the president had to take a little vacation. I don't know. He couldn't quite stand the pressure there, I'm afraid. And the head of or the vice president of Ford Motor is coming to run the place, who's the chair of the board of trustees. And we thought, well, he may treat us a little differently. So we marched to the quadrangle of the university. There were 200 of us. And about a day later, there were 2,000. And in a silent vigil in front of the Duke Chapel. And pretty soon, the non-academic employees went on strike, and a bunch of the faculties went on strike. And 4 days later, we won. And I said, gee whiz, this kind of organizing works. I could do this for a career. So that's what I've done. And I got involved with Saul Alinsky's last project in Chicago when I went there to graduate school, and I've been in Chicago ever since.
If I could, I would. I think our listeners would be interested maybe to know a little bit about the woman to whom you are married. You call her in the acknowledgments to the book. I mean, I don't remember exactly, but something like the best political strategist you've ever encountered. You've probably known some very, very good ones. Tell us a little bit about your partnership, maybe both professional and personal. And the kind of things that you have perhaps learned from her over the years.
Well, when I was working for that last Alinsky project called the Campaign Against Pollution, then was called the Citizens Action Program after it switched to other issues, a broader array of issues. I ran into her. She was with a group of Northwest suburban housewives, had organized a little group they modestly called National Consumers United. I think there were six of them, to get freshness dates on food. Back then, there were no freshness dates on food. And they came to us to talk about organizing because they were doing a pretty good job of getting press, but they weren't making the progress they wanted against the food chains. And they actually, I think the first time I saw her, she was on TV on the nightly news, the Huntley Brinkley Report, confronting the chairman of Jewel Foods, who was saying, or maybe it was National Foods, who was saying that she was either a communist or a agent of National Tea Company, the other competing company, which I got a charge out of. In any case, I really wanted to meet her, and she was married, and I was married, and we were we both worked together there. And then when I started the statewide organization that we created, Illinois Public Action, it became Illinois Citizen Action later, I hired her as one of our organizers. And a number of years later, both our former spouses fired us, and we got together, and that was 44 years ago. So we've been married a long time. She's a very astute. She understands one of the principles of politics that I think in political communication is so important. Maya Angelou says this. They won't remember what you say. They won't remember what you do. But they'll never forget how you make them feel.
Mm-hmm.
She understands that, and she's really good at communicating with ordinary voters, and that's why she was first in the state legislature and now in Congress for the last, 26 years.
Very good. We're speaking with Robert Creamer. He is the author of a new book called Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success, a really interesting book that examines a lot of different facets of sort of political life and the way in which campaigns need to be run in this current environment in which we find ourselves. And of course, I'm anxious to get your take on this most recent national election, but I do want to touch first on a couple of basic points about your really interesting book. One of them is I'm intrigued by the fact that your subtitle calls this a book that is really meant for progressives to gain success in elections. I'm just curious, are there reasons why these suggestions are, in your mind, more applicable to people who are on the progressive side of the spectrum. I should think that actually a lot of these basics could also be a formula for success for those on the other side of the political aisle.
I think you're absolutely right. Now, the book is written from a progressive perspective and aimed at progressive organizers and campaigns and candidates who want to be successful, because that's what I do. But you're correct, absolutely, that a number of the most of the principles that are elaborated there are applicable to anybody who's running for office and could be applicable to nonpartisan kind of local races or whatever as well. I mean, the kind of qualities that that voters look for and from a persuasion point of view, the kind of messages that motivate voters to go out and vote, the basic principles of political communication, and the basic principles of field organizing and the qualities of great organizers and so on. All of those things are directly applicable to everybody. Mm. You're absolutely right.
I also wonder about the fact that you have been doing this for a long, long time. And, of course, I don't need to tell you, of all people, how much the world has changed over the
right.
course of these, especially over the last decade or two, in terms of the way people interact with each other, the way people get their information, the way people engage in communication and receive communication, and so on. I'm just curious, maybe on sort of more of a personal sort of level, what has it been like for you to do this kind of work and to have had to shift gears, I should think, rather dramatically to address this very, very different environment in which we now find ourselves versus once upon a time when you first began your work as a political organizer and activist?
Well, a lot of the principles of great organizing have not changed. And I think that the kind of messages that people are resonant with have not changed a lot. The means of communication have changed. I mean, social media has become an extraordinarily important source both of news and to motivate people to do things and to announce things. The same is true with email. Email is good with is a good vehicle to announce things, but it's not such a great vehicle to debate things on or to try and organize on. I mean, organizing, I believe, still today is about developing relationships. And there's a limited amount you can do over the Internet to develop true relationships. It has lots of utility, and we use it, and we should use it more. Podcasts with trusted messengers, influencers on social media who are trusted messengers. Very important for us to have those and develop, and more of them, in particularly in places like Kenosha, who are local and or who are trusted by people who live in the community. But fundamentally, if I walk into a room and hear nothing but clicking on a computer, people who are supposed to be organizers, you know, I say, look, no, organizing is about relationships. I want you to be around people's kitchen tables. I want you to be on the phone with them, because at least, you know, 70-80% of communication is nonverbal. And just ask poor Joe Biden, who had that debate where what he said was not the issue, but the way he sounded, his tone of voice, his facial expressions, his posture. That's so important, and you lose all of that if you don't have face-to-face communication with people. So I'm still a big advocate of no kidding around, talking to ordinary people face-to-face and getting to know them and getting to understand them, because understanding self-interest is still the fundamental element of being a great organizer.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about this recently waged presidential campaign between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. And, of course, we all know how that election ultimately turned out. First of all, a really, really basic question. Were you surprised at what the at how this election turned out?
The answer is yes. I mean, I personally believed that our extraordinarily large edge among women voters and that our superior field operation would carry the day. I and many others underestimated one thing, and that was the degree of unhappiness and dissatisfaction of ordinary working-class voters with the way things are going for their lives, and the extent to which this is kind of been a global phenomenon in the last number of years. I mean, other factors, you know, the deluge of misinformation, the millions spent by a few billionaires also played a role, racism, sexism, clearly. But the main thing is that there's a feeling on the part of many ordinary Americans that the system, the American economy, are not delivering for them. And when you feel like that, you want to throw the incumbents out. I mean, NBC News' exit polls showed 68% of those who voted said the economy was not too good or poor. 58% said inflation caused their families moderate or severe hardship. And 73% were dissatisfied or angry at the direction of the country. That's a hard win to run against. And and my personal view is the underlying cause of that, and this kind of gets to what I would say is the major lesson from this election, is that even though economic indicators showed unemployment was low and job creation robust and growth is high, you know, when people say, well, the economy's good, and ordinary people hear that. Now, the economy is their economy. And if it ain't good for them, then you're just out of touch.
Right. So in other words, you can point to all kinds of different statistics, but that doesn't mean that for a given person that they aren't feeling the effects of, for instance, inflation and so on, and particularly all kinds of people in our country living in particular places that have perhaps been hit especially hard. And
factory towns that have been denuded of jobs by bad trade deals. And that's absolutely right. But you know, you'd think that since America is the richest country in the world, at the richest time in world history, that ordinary people would think the prospects for their kids and themselves are better than their parents would be. But there's a reason why that is not true. And that is that since 1973, after the war, after World War II, there was what we call the Great Compression. Everybody's incomes went up, but the incomes of ordinary people went up faster than those for the rich. Starting about 1973, that trend reversed itself. And we've seen more and more income inequality in the United States and the Western world in general. Now, there are reasons for that and structural reasons for why that's happened that we have to address if we're going to take seriously the interest of ordinary people. And, you know, CEO pay has zoomed compared to worker pay. The percentage of every dollar of gross domestic product that goes to labor has dropped. I mean, and that's why people who make under $100,000 a year, 60% of them get smaller and smaller percentages of our gross domestic product every year. And that makes people think they are not getting ahead. And so whatever the fluctuations are, that underlying condition, in my judgment, progressives need to deal with. And we've seen this wave of incumbents being thrown out. I mean, you know, Trump was thrown out in 2020. We'll do a lot better in 2026 because Trump will be the incumbent.
Hmm. Well, and another thing that's probably worth acknowledging is that that wave of incumbents facing real difficulty is not even limited to the United States, but really,
right.
In the wake of COVID, incumbents all over the Western world have been feeling the heat. So in some respects, correct, that we should, it's a mistake to look at this solely through, in a sense, American eyes.
That's correct. And there's no doubt about, I mean, part of the reason for the increased amount going to investors and so on, as opposed to workers, is that technology has made productivity per hour go up, and that often has been grabbed by corporations and the wealthy to put in their own pockets instead of shared with workers, and that's a problem. So my argument is that one of the things we have to do differently in the coming elections is to lead with economics and to be much more populist in our discussion. By populist, I mean you don't just name the pain, you name the perpetrator of the pain, the cause. I mean, you have to say, you know, why do Republicans want to cut Medicare? To give tax breaks to millionaires. That's why. That's true. I mean, why do they? I mean, it's the narrative. Any political narrative has a protagonist and an antagonist. Trump created an antagonist that was immigrants, was the enemy within, the liberals, and so on. We needed to be clear that it's Trump and his billionaire pals, and they're right out there to see, are in it for themselves. And our candidate, in the case of Kamala, is in it for us, all of us, together. If that's the narrative, we have a much better chance of winning.
I think some people would argue that did get said. I mean, and I myself heard that being said, but is it that it's not, that it was not central enough, or is it that the way it was said was, is that the issue? Or, I mean, what would you have done differently in terms of that particular message, for instance?
Yeah, I think it was said. It just was not said as the principal thematic, particularly toward the end of the campaign. There was an attempt being made to win over Republicans. Let's just say this. Instead of touring with Liz Cheney, I think I'd have been touring with Sean Fain from the auto workers. I mean, I thought the choice of Tim Walz was marvelous on exactly the score I just described. Because you got to talk like normal people, not about, you know, the other side's narrative is that the antagonist is the elites from the coasts, you know, and part of their view is, of course, a lot of ordinary people think that they're disrespected too, that their people look down their nose on them, and that we got to end. People have got to believe that the Democratic Party is their home, and part of that also comes from year-round organizing, year-round developing structures where ordinary people and communities believe they own not just the Democratic Party, but progressive institutions that speak for them, and that the structure is owned by them, and that they're engaged, not just talked to right before an election. Could Kamala have won that race if something had been done differently? It was hard. Incumbency was a hard thing to shake. But we'd have to do everything we can to demonstrate we're fighting for ordinary people. I'd say one thing I would not have done is to ever say, oh, the economy's really good. I mean, because people hear that for whom it is not good, and say they're out of touch.
Right, right. One of the realities that Kamala Harris faced, well, two of them. One of them was being linked, of course, to the current president, Joe Biden, a president with not high approval ratings. And the other thing was, of course, this whole scenario of being the presidential candidate for only 107 days.
7 days. And that's right. And both those were big limitations. I couldn't agree more. Mm. Yeah. And I will say this, too. I mean, let's be clear. Joe Biden is one of the best presidents we've had in many, many years, delivered so much for ordinary people, and has been so effective in the face of so many difficulties. He recovered from the pandemic. We I mean, all of this stuff we talk about, it's all true in terms of jobs and so on. But this fundamental problem of, I mean, we have to be going after, and Biden did this in administration, it wasn't kind of center stage for people, corporate concentration, monopolies, very popular. The kind of messaging we're talking about is very popular in the swing states among the voters in swing states, many of which voted for Trump. If we talk about tax breaks for millionaires, people say, you're right, they shouldn't be getting big tax breaks. That, by the way, is one of the first things that Trump will try to do, and presumably, and extend the tax breaks for millionaires. And that is a fight we want to have.
We're speaking with Robert Creamer. He is someone who has worked on the progressive side of the political aisle for many, many years as a political organizer and strategist. And he is the author of a new book called Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success. Before we dig into your book, I want to just circle back to this matter of trying to find a way to speak more effectively to a certain swath of the population with which I think you are suggesting, and I think a lot of people are suggesting, the Democratic Party has maybe lost its mojo. I mean, not a swath of the population to which they are not communicating all that effectively, or not as effectively as they need to make some inroads. And,
right,
of course, part of that swath of the population, I think it's fair to say, are people who are not necessarily all that politically engaged. I mean,
right,
in the sense of not spending hours, you know, listening to podcasts and reading the newspaper and digesting sort of political stuff on a regular basis. It's people who are busy living their lives and taking in information, you know, in maybe a bit more cursory fashion. What is your suggestion for, or suggestions for the Democratic Party in terms of gaining a greater connection with these kind of voters?
Well, one thing is that, I mean, whenever I do a training for organizers, you know, I start out by saying, now, let's remember, none of you in this room are normal people. Normal people think about politics, you know, 15 minutes, half an hour a week, right? I mean, like you say. And we, our job is to communicate with normal people, which means that we have to connect stuff to their lives very concretely. Now, things like reproductive choice are very concrete for many, many women, and many men too. And that's a very important issue. And there's no doubt we should be talking about that as this battle continues and trying our best to win these battles. But the best way we can define the narrative is who's on whose side is with a fight. We have to do battle with these guys if they try and do things that harm ordinary people. And they have to be loud, and they have to be forceful battles that frame the battle the way we want, the way they ought to be framed, and the way we want our narrative to be. So, like I say, it's not just they want to cut the ACA or eliminate the hands off my health care. You know, that's good, but you know, they want to take away my health care so they can give tax breaks to millionaires. That's right. That is the fundamental driving force here, and we ought to be talking about that a lot. But more importantly, we need to engage people in that battle from all sectors of the population. And because the best way to convince people of anything is to put them in motion. If somebody acts themselves into, people act themselves into beliefs and commitments more easily than they can be convinced. So we got to get them to pay attention by putting them in motion. And I know there are a lot of organizations ready to do that. The most important organization for working Americans is the labor movement. And the labor movement is more popular than it has been for years. There are lots and lots of people, lots and lots of unions that have had a lot of victories lately. And we need to do everything we can both to strengthen it and to engage it in the broader struggle for control of the direction of the society, it seems to me.
Let's begin digging into some of what you talk about in your book. And I think there are certain core principles that will resonate with those of us who just experienced this most recent election. A lot of your book is about organizing and political organizations. And you say something quite intriguing, I think, early in the book that I would love to have you expand upon. And when you say that the culture of a successful or a great political organization is fun. And you say fun is especially important in politics because politics is so dependent upon volunteers, and also because fun tends to be attractive. I have to say, I never really stopped to think about either of those, but I can't think of anything that's probably more fundamentally important for a political organization. And it's just interesting to think about it because, of course, I think a lot of us think of the political arena as anything but fun in this yeah. in this current environment. I'd love to hear a little more about sort of the kind of fun that you are talking about, or the ways in which a spirit of fun can be sort of rolled into a lot of other parts of the political process that are pretty tough.
Well, I mean, the Harris campaign actually got a lot of that right. Boy, they, you know, by talking about joy and the Democratic convention was fun. I mean, fun in a lot of, because people were happy and joyous, and you know, people like happy, joyous. They don't like mean and angry, really. That's all to the good. But I mean, being part of the organization needs to be fun too. You know, I remember when I was first a community organizer that ran other organizers, who led a team of organizers. The guy who was my mentor, said to me a couple months after I just started, says, "So have you thrown a party for him yet?" You know, I mean, because that allows people to bond and feel, you know, like they're pals. Now, it's true that being in battle together is one of the things that bonds people a lot, and that's all great. But you got to build in the elements of enjoyment and in order to make something a success, in order to keep volunteers coming back. I mean, like you say, volunteers are so much a part of politics, and you know, they're getting paid in the currency of their self-interests, which are often wanting to be part of something important, or sometimes it's wanting to get out of the house. Sometimes it's wanting to, you know, whatever it may be. But one element of that is almost always that in the relationships they develop with other people, they find them enjoyable and fun.
I think another interesting point you make as you are talking about the importance of this spirit of fun is that somehow that also can perhaps help generate something really important, that is the capacity to turn negatives into positives. And of course, right. if you're going to be engaged in the business of politics, and especially at a time when our country is so deeply and bitterly divided, there are going to be all kinds of negative things that occur, some within your own control, some of your own making perhaps, or sometimes just plain old bad luck. And the capacity to find something positive or generate something positive out of the almost inevitable setbacks, I think you're pointing to something really important there.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of Saul Alinsky's big things. Your job is to turn negatives into positive, turn weakness into strength, turn difficulty into success. And, you know, I mean, if you talk about the civil rights movement, for instance, I mean, their one of their strengths was their willingness to stand up and fight in the midst of water hoses and whatever. But you know what? Those water hoses turned into symbols that made them successful. One of the great examples of negatives into positives was Barack Obama was a state senator when he challenged Congressman Bobby Rush for Congress in a reelection campaign for Rush. And Rush beat him. And if Barack Obama had not lost that race for Congress, 2 years later, I think it was 2 years, he would not have run for the Senate because he would have lost his House seat. And if he had not run for the Senate, he wouldn't have been president of the United States. And he'll tell you right now, it's one of the best things that ever happened to him.
Wow.
So that was turning a negative into a positive. But I guess that the major point is to create out of whatever weakness you have, how can you turn that into something that provides you more strength?
When it comes to just the matter of connecting with voters and making inroads and making progress and so on, you come back again and again to this whole matter of field operations and the importance of field operations. And one of the things you tell us is that the importance of this seemed to sort of fade from view for a time and now, in a sense, has been reclaimed. First of all, remind our listeners of basically what you mean by that term, field operations, and why they are maybe more important than ever.
Well, I mean, ordinary people talking to their friends and neighbors on the phone, but better yet, face-to-face, at the door, at events, where real relationships can be engaged, and where you can communicate directly with them, particularly about turnout. A number of people said, "Well, all that the superior field operation that the Harris campaign, which it did, didn't matter as much in these battleground communities as we thought." Well, wasn't enough, but around the United States, Kamala got about 7-8% less vote than Biden did in 2020. Except in the battleground states, it was about 2%, 2.5% less. I mean, there was a big difference in those states, and a lot of that was attributable to the field operations that were far, far superior. And you know, there are a number of things that motivate people to vote. Field operations are particularly important in terms of motivation. They're also important in terms of voter ID, and I'll get back to that in a second. But, you know, one of them is motivation. I mean, pardon me, is inspiration. But another one is, I won't get off your porch until you vote. You know, just show it up. Really increases, empirically, will increase the likelihood somebody behind the door will vote. And that's a critical element of politics. Now, one of the other things that field operations do is to help us with voter ID. Great campaigns are like treasure hunts. Our job is to find enough voters to hit a winning number that we know from past history will get us elected. A great campaign wants to go into election day with a list of voters. If they all vote, we're going to win. And a real list with names. And so that as we move through the election period, which is now longer than a day, of course, we're in a position to just mark off those people as they vote and zero in on the people who haven't voted to get them out. We find those voters who might vote for us a variety of ways. One is by looking at past voter history. You know, if somebody votes in Democratic primaries, they're likely to vote Democratic in the general election. Same is true with Republicans. But a bunch of people we got to find by asking, particularly in primary elections. You got to ask, can we count on your support for Joe Schmo? And you believe people pretty much when they tell you, because people are pretty honest about that. Anyway, so that's one of the things that field operations do in great campaigns. Great campaigns, it's not rocket science. It's finding your voters and getting them out.
Mm. Could you explain a important distinction between two terms, finding persuadables and finding mobilizables. Okay, mobilizables. Explain the difference between that.
Well, first off, political campaigns about changing people's behavior. I mean, if it weren't about doing that, if our campaign was aimed at just letting them do what they were going to do anyway, we might as well all go to the beach. I mean, and there are only two groups of people whose behavior can be changed in elections. One are people who are undecided but are likely to vote. Those people are persuadables. The other group of people are people who would vote for us but just may not get off their couch. We had a lot of those this election, by the way, still. And and they are mobilizables. They are people who would vote for our side if we could just get them out. The messages to persuadables center on the candidate. They center on the qualities of the candidate that will make the voter feel that this candidate is with them. I mean, persuasion is more like a love affair than some kind of rational calculation. Just like a love affair, you're not trying to make the other person think you're the greatest thing in the world. You're trying to make them feel like in your presence, they feel great about themselves. And there are a variety of qualities that candidates have that can do that, that can convince them you're on their side, that you're a strong, effective leader that can get things done for us, that you can, you believe in what you stand for. For mobilizables, the message is different. It's not about the candidate so much. It's about the voter. Your job is to motivate the voter to make them feel it's worth their while to go out and vote. Now, there's one quality that works on both mobilization and persuasion that is so important, and that is inspiration. That's making people feel empowered, that they are part of something bigger than themselves, but that they themselves can provide a significant role in achieving the greater goal. I mean, that's particularly important for persuasion because that's making you feel good about your self-empowerment. It's great for mobilization because one of the reasons people don't vote is because they think they don't matter. Lower-income people very often are less likely to vote because nothing they do in life really seems to, they don't feel like they have agency at all. You give them a sense of agency, and they're more likely to get out and vote. So that's very important there.
I want to touch on a couple other interesting points in your book. One of them is when you are talking about the importance of staffing your field organization and the kind of people that you want. And one really great phrase is hire for attitude, train for skill. That idea that, you know, you want people with great potential, the right attitude, the right sort of can-do spirit, and even if they don't come to you with the specific skills that are maybe especially important, those skills can be taught, but it's so important to start with just kind of the right person. But I want to ask you about something else you say when you say, we generally prefer that the paid organizers come from out of town so they don't have a life beyond the campaign.
I thought that terrible. Was really... That's terrible, isn't it?
terrible and yet probably really true because, in a sense, you know, some of those people, I mean, this is really backbreaking work, you say, you know, in terms of the number of hours spent, it just kind of swallows up your whole life. And there is something to be said for somebody who does not have to bring their kid to Little League practice or whatever, or having other sort of pressing engagements. I mean, there really is something kind of all-encompassing about this kind of work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like being a soldier. You know, it really is. I mean, you're all in when you're an organizer in a political campaign. And by the way, you develop this kind of relationships as soldiers do very often in battle. You know, the people who are you go to battle for and within these campaigns become your closest friends for life. And you know, I very often run into organizers who, it's right at the end of the campaign, they say, "Oh my gosh, I would never do this again. This is just too hard. This is hard." And then an election night, they come up to you and say, "Where do I sign up for doing another one of these?" Because it's like an epiphany that suddenly it all comes together. I don't mean to indicate that. In fact, the job of the organizer is to find leaders as people who have followers, influencers, there are people who are good salespeople, and to build an organization of local people. The best political organizations are led by local people, that is, people who run, who have followers. You know, we always, in trainings, but people do an exercise, what are the key qualities of leaders, great leaders? And of course, in the end, all these qualities that people spurt out are only incidental to the one quality that matters. A leader has followers by definition. That may be the head of the Altar and Rosary Society at the church. It may be somebody on the internet who has lots of followers. It may be a neighbor who just knows everybody in the neighborhood. And the job of the organizer is to find leaders, engage their self-interest in becoming part of the campaign, and letting them feel like they own the effort that they're engaged in. And that is one of the things we have to do going forward, particularly in working communities. I mean, you know, we had lots of people going from all over the country into swing communities like Kenosha to help knock on doors, and that's all good. The good news about Wisconsin is it's run by the state Democratic Party, is run by a guy named Penn Wickler, who's just one of the best organizers I've ever met. There is really an attempt being made to build local communities, parties, Democratic parties. In a lot of other places, that's not so much the case. We really need to bear down on making these things locally run by local leaders. Mm-hmm. But the organizer is different than the leader. The organizer facilitates that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly explore a whole lot of interesting facets of how all of this works and how all of this sometimes fails to work the way that you know, one might want. And there's just a tremendous amount of food for thought here. And the book, again, is titled Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success. The book is published by Strong Arm Press. The author, Robert Creamer. Robert Creamer, I'm so glad we had this opportunity to speak together about your very, very interesting book. Thank you so much, and very best wishes to you.
Thanks so much for your time, and onward and upward.
And I'm hoping that tomorrow we're going to be able to preview for you the next theatrical production of the University of Wisconsin Parkside, a really intriguing-sounding play, which is called Hand to God. So we are still working to see if that interview can take place for tomorrow's morning show. Next week, we'll include a conversation with Dr. Thomas Carr from the Paleontology Institute at Carthage, and also an online tribute to the late Norm McPhee, longtime artistic and managing director of the Racine Theater Guild, as we hear from an array of people who had the pleasure of working with Norm McPhee over the course of many years. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. A winter weather advisory remains in effect until 12 noon. We are seeing snow showers fall right now at our WGTD studios. By later today, it will warm to the extent where we will have rain showers instead of snow, possibly 2 to 3 inches of wet snow accumulation before we're done, with a high of 43 degrees. Rain expected to continue overnight. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and